Looks like a cold, cold winter. Plenty of ice and snow. But we'll keep the love light in our hearts aglow. Looks like a long, long Bing Crosby.
Vocal boy, born in Tacoma, raised in Spokane.
Couldn't figure it was Bing Crosby, Dean Martin, Perry Como.
They're kind of all the same. I think they're all subtle. Yeah, the nuances there are hard to get some.
That's right. Felix Bonnell is here. There are only a few days of summer left, of course, but we've already had plenty of unsettled weather. But if you want the really stormy stuff, you have to go way back to the winter of 1861-62, and one local scientist has done just that. Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System.
Yeah, you know, the history of extreme weather around here was pretty well documented going back to the late 19th century. You know, you got the Columbus Day storm of 1962, the blizzard of 1916, even that big snow of 1880. There's official weather records, diary entries, newspaper accounts, and photographs. Before 1880, though, the records are pretty spotty. And that's why Larry Schick, longtime King 5 weatherman and later a scientist for the Army Corps of Engineers, got excited when he made a discovery.
I was totally thrilled. I mean, I was so excited because a lot of this is a treasure hunt, you know, and this was one of the big things, the treasure hunts. And when I find you have it, and I thought, wow, you gotta send, you know, copies to me right now. You know, because I had looked all over Washington. Nobody had it here. Weather Service, UW, nobody had it. But I knew it existed because I saw it referenced.
And what Larry had finally tracked down was a report from the Secretary of War published in 1888. He struck pay dirt at UC Berkeley, which is one of the older colleges west of the Rockies. Now, in this report are detailed weather observations from U.S. Army forts all over the Northwest, going back as early as the 1840s. What he was specifically looking for was data, you know, real numbers, about that epic winter of 1861-1862. And this weather data was collected not by meteorologists, but by Army surgeons. This was back when weather was considered to have a direct relation to health. And what was it about the winter of 1861-1862 that made it so worth chasing down?
People here saw some of the biggest storminess along the West Coast, really from Washington, Oregon, and California, that really we've ever seen. It's not that we haven't seen bigger storms or maybe even deeper cold, but the consistency of it was so huge. And the peak flows of the rivers, especially in Oregon and California, were like something we have not seen before. The cold here was incredible here in the Pacific Northwest, but it was a progression of things that happened over about 8 weeks.
Yeah, and the period we're talking about is roughly late November 1861 to early February of 1862, but there was snow on the ground as late as June in parts of eastern Washington, in the shady parts over by Walla Walla. Now, there were huge floods in Oregon, especially southern Oregon, and in northern California. Here in Washington Territory, which until 1863 included all of present-day Idaho, so that's when we were, those were our glory days, it was more about snow and extreme cold.
So Seattle, during that time, I got a variety of temperatures. I had a Woodland Park, which is up by the zoo, temperature of 4 below 0. Downtown Seattle was about 2 below 0. And kind of the modern record is near zero. It is zero at SeaTac. And so we're close to that. East of the mountains, much colder, and the cold lasted a long time. I had 29 degrees below zero in Walla Walla.
Yeah, so that's pretty cold. And the cold from that winter of 1861-62 lingered in people's memories. Now, historian Clarence Bagley, he wrote his three-volume history of Seattle in 1916, and he said this, quote, "Fruit trees were killed in many orchards, and large numbers of livestock died from the severity of the weather. In Seattle, ice 6 inches thick covered all of Lake Union, and the snow lay on the ground 13 weeks. The mercury fell below zero several times," unquote. Now, there was huge loss of livestock, especially east of the Cascades, because of the months of cold and deep snow. They just couldn't get to the grass to eat it. And in Oregon and California, because of these massive floods. As for humans, Larry Schick says there's no comprehensive list of casualties. He estimates the number of people who died is somewhere between dozens and hundreds. Now, in that Secretary of War's report that he tracked down, Larry did find some interesting things in the data. He spotted one wintertime pattern in 1861 that would sound very familiar to Puget Sound residents in 2019.
I could pick out these atmospheric rivers, these Pineapple Express warm and wet patterns that really caused most of our flooding. I could pick those out really easy, and it was easy to pick one out in Vancouver, Washington in early December of 1861. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. It was 59 degrees in the morning, early December. It's never that warm. There's only one thing that can do that, and that's an atmospheric river, what we call Pineapple Express, too. These warm and very wet Hawaiian storms that give us our biggest rains and our flooding in the Pacific Northwest. And that was, when I saw that, in Vancouver, Washington, that observation, I said, that's it. And sure enough, the papers, big floods the next 2 days, huge flood. We've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, and I asked you, what about seeing something like it again? Is the winter of 1861, 1862 part of a cycle that might repeat someday?
In this case, I think it was just a random event. You know, I think that winter was just random. It was extreme, and it's not like the individual storms aren't close to something we've already seen. I think what's unusual is this concentration in this 8-week period, especially the rain when it really starts to turn on.
Yeah, so Larry's working on a book about this. It'll be published sometime in the next couple of years. Some of the challenges, there's no known photos from that winter up here in Washington and Oregon. There's a few from California, these crazy photographs of Sacramento, pretty much, you know, record high floods. We do have some cool maps and related images at My Northwest. And, you know, I go around the state giving talks for Humanities Washington. And I'm starting off the new season next Thursday giving my weather history talk over in Ellensburg at the Kittitas County Museum. It's at 6 o'clock next Thursday evening. Admission's free. So we do have all this great stuff at MyNorthwest.com about this very bizarre outlier winter of 1861, 1862.
And Lake Union actually froze. I've never seen Lake Union freeze.
That's happened a few times, not in living memory, but it's happened a few times in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. But yeah, and then Columbia River froze as well. People could walk back and forth from Portland to Vancouver. It was just intense, deep cold for weeks.
Lake Washington's never frozen?
I think Lake Washington is too wide across. Probably bays probably froze, but I don't think the center part. It's just too deep.
We'll keep looking in the records.
Yeah, we'll ask Larry.
You never know what you'll find.
Go down to Berkeley. See, they might have a copy.
Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System. As Puget Sound Energy requested, the Seattle City Council has pressed pause on a ban on natural gas hookups. But for the heating oil tax, that's full speed ahead. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Dave, both of these proposals are in line with Seattle's commitment to its Green New Deal to get the city climate pollution free by 2030. The proposal to ban natural gas in all new homes and commercial buildings starting next year came from Councilmember Mike O'Brien just a couple of weeks ago. He had planned to vote this out of committee yesterday, but that took a turn after dozens showed up to express concerns. Among those speaking out, small business owners who sell things like fireplaces and gas stoves.
This equates to millions of dollars in revenue loss. We are talking job losses here from a manufacturer level to a small business level.
This is not just about jobs at our factory, but the retailers, the service people, the installers, the gas companies, the guys that run the gas lines, the guys that service those gas lines. It's everybody.
We have over 150 families that are employed with us, and you know, they're at huge risk of losing jobs if this ordinance was to go through.
What we would like to do is come together and talk about logical ways to offer our customers options other than just mandates.
There was also a major showing from utilities and from the building trades, one I hadn't seen since the head tax was up.
We are concerned that if this legislation is passed, it would result in the loss of family wage paying work. Our members that work in this industry contribute to this local economy and community. There was no analysis or feasibility study on how this bill will impact the electric grid and the natural gas system.
Please understand that this will hurt everybody.
We ask you simply slow it down a little bit.
We believe it's time to stop, take an in-depth look at the issues, and work on constructive solutions, including a feasibility study, together in 2020.
That last speaker was Andy Wappler from PSE, who, like most others there, called for a 12-month pause to do a feasibility study and get all the voices involved in this conversation. A lot of people there complained about what they saw was a very, very rushed process on this particular legislation. About three climate activists showed up to speak in favor of the ban. In the end, O'Brien seemed to hear those with concerns.
I hear the concerns. My original intent was to vote on this legislation today. I'm not going to do that today. You're right. I need to get more input and hear some more feedback from folks.
But he also stressed that this was a necessary step to meet the city's climate goals.
I wish we had 20 or 30 years to figure this out. I wish we had started in earnest on conversations like this 20 or 30 years ago. But I don't get to change the science. And I fear that because every year in the last 10 years, every time we get new data points, it's worse than we think, that trend will continue. And so there's a sense of urgency around that. But another key principle of the Green New Deal, a critical piece, is this transition away from fossil fuels can't be disproportionately on the backs of people that are on the front line, whether those are workers or small business owners.
So in the end, he did push a temporary pause on this. He's expected to take the next 6 to 8 weeks to talk to all of those various parties who have concerns, and we'll see where we go from there. At that same meeting, a proposal for a heating oil tax did get voted out of committee, despite some concerns from a handful of people who showed up to speak out against it.
When will you do a programmatic risk assessment of should these tanks even be disturbed? An equity analysis of the homeowners that would have to bear the cost and risk of not only converting their heat source, but potentially digging up their yards to pull out tanks.
We believe there are many homeowners on fixed incomes with oil heat whose incomes exceed the $34,000 or so yearly income limit that would qualify them for conversion assistance.
So this is a proposal, of course, from Mayor Durkin and Mike O'Brien that would see a tax of 24 cents per gallon on heating oil providers starting next year to pay for programs that would help people switch over to electric heat. This cleared committee yesterday with some amendments. They changed the qualification, income qualification for those who will get these subsidies up from 70% of the annual median income to 80%. So $45,000, $50,000, I think, to qualify for that help now.
I can see the switch away from heating oil. On the natural gas thing and the whole Green New Deal, is there any discussion about the practicality of a city on its own trying to avert climate change without some sort of national consensus?
No. As far as the city doing it on its own without the national doing whatever the nation is doing, this is Seattle looking to do it on its own because there has been a lack of progress on the national level, and they're not going to wait. But there's also some who see, look, there's a lot of these folks heading out of council trying to get their items passed that they've wanted to get done for some time. As far as feasibility, no, there's
questions. I get they want to plant a stake in the ground, but they'd have to admit it's symbolic at this point. And if you're going to, you don't sacrifice jobs for symbolism, do you?
No, and that's, I think it became clear in listening to this committee hearing yesterday, especially on the national gas ban, that Mike O'Brien absolutely did hear from these people. Yeah. There was so many people who said it was rushed. So many people who said, you haven't talked to us, not the utilities, not the construction workers, not the homeowners. You've got to do that. And so he's going to push pause now. So we'll see.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Remember the story we did last week on shoplifting? Got a lot of reaction to that from frustrated people. Car Radio's Carolyn Osorio had profiled a local woman who's been fired from two retail jobs now because both of those companies have policies against stopping shoplifters. They considered to be too much trouble. And this worker had tried to stop people who she saw stealing, which violated those policies and got her fired. So we called up the National Association for Shoplifting Prevention. As the name implies, they think they have figured out a way to prevent shoplifting. I talked with Barbara Stabe, who is the group's director of communications.
First, I can't and won't and don't speak for any retailer individually. Mm-hmm. That said, you use the word too much trouble. Let me be clear that it's not that it's too much trouble. It is fraught with too much liability. So there are retailers out there who are actively apprehending shoplifters and trying to report it to police departments every day and every offense. And some of them are getting fines from the community, from the police department, from the government entity behind the police department for overuse of resources, of criminal justice and community resources. So it's a double-edged sword. So to say that the retailers are kind of just ignoring it because it's just too much trouble, there's an awful lot of information missing there. There's a lot behind why it's too much trouble. It's difficult.
So how do you get the police interested in at least investigating these crimes?
I think it's about collaboration. I think the answer here is we live in 2019, and we still have a criminal justice system with resources established maybe back in the 50s and 60s. And so in defense of the criminal justice system, the fact is they have fixed resources and growing crime to deal with. And I think the answer is collaboration. So to work together to identify people for whom maybe you don't need the criminal justice system. Education is a powerful tool. It's currently used throughout the criminal justice system, but it's not used in advance of the criminal justice system. And so I'll give you the example of a young person. Any parent will know that shoplifting is often a child's first touch point with criminal justice because they get involved on a dare or peer pressure. Why does that have to be a start down the spiral of criminal justice when education might change that child's behavior and their life right then and there? So we are large proponents of shoplifting education that can be provided immediately upon apprehension, whether that's by the retailer, and then it's a civil voluntary program, or by the police directly. So instead of arresting that person, they tell them, you go do this education program and come back to me when you've completed it. So there are many, many options, and I think the key to expanding the use and expanding the how far everybody's resources go is to collaborate.
In the programs that you offer at the National Association for Shoplifting Prevention, what's your magic bullet? Once you get somebody who's been apprehended and they're in class, what is it you tell them that changes them?
Well, so I can't give you the secret sauce, but the fact is it's not rocket science. It is years of study, years of speaking to offenders, understanding offenders. And the big key to the program is that we don't lecture them. We don't wag a finger and say shoplifting is wrong, it's against the law, and, you know, it's a sin. Offenders know that. People who shoplift, whether they do it out of criminality or out of need or just out of mental illness or whatever reason, they know it was wrong before they shoplifted. So the question we have to address is, why did they shoplift anyway? So that's the question we address. What made you do this knowing that it's against the law, that there are cameras, there are asset protection people, that there are consequences to this.
So what are your results? Can you give me what are the numbers say?
Yeah, so less than 3% of the people who complete an education program that we provide, whether that's an adult or a juvenile, will repeat their offense within, depending on the length of the recidivism study, they're usually 3 to 5 to 7 years long.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, King County, Seattle, actually, Superior Court in King County, Washington, found that not only is the Youth Educational Shoplifting Program, which is our juvenile program, effective in preventing future shoplifting among youth, it's effective in preventing their involvement in any kind of crime.
Well, that's great. So we're using it here in King County right now?
We do serve King County. Juveniles in King County.
Juveniles. But the key is then for that program to kick in, the juvenile has to be apprehended, correct?
Yes. They not only have to be apprehended, they have to be arrested, and then the case has to be put through the diversion program. So there's a big cost to the community every time someone gets apprehended, arrested, prosecuted. It's somewhere between $2,500 and $3,000 to process a petty offender through the system. That's a huge cost to the community. What if we could use education at the time of apprehension with the consent and cooperation of the criminal justice authorities in the community to offer that education and take the people off the plate of criminal justice for whom education is a better intervention.
Right.
It's more valuable. It will change their behavior. And 'cause Dave, I don't think many of your listeners would disagree that the criminal justice system is not a place to learn not to be a criminal.
Barbara Stabe is the Director of Communications for the National Association for Shoplifting Prevention. Barbara, thank you very much.
Dave, thank you so much for inviting me.
What she's talking about there is actually a pretty radical change. It would be the store's loss prevention officers. I don't like to call them security guards. The loss prevention officers catch somebody shoplifting. There's an agreement with the police that the store itself can tell the suspect, either you go to education, which will help you pay for it, or we're going to take you into court. And I think a few cities have tried that, but it is a tough lift. A lot of groups seem to lobby against that kind of solution. We will follow up on that and see what King County is, in fact, doing.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. Promise not to lose it like I did yesterday. So this is a sweet story.
Right.
I always gauge a good daily dose of kindness story on if I cry at my desk first.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to bring that to on air, but according to a few people, it was very cleansing yesterday to have a happy cry with me. So let's do that again together. Maddox Seals started kindergarten this year, but the big day came with a heavy heart. His dad is a Louisiana police officer. He died in the line of duty. But Maddox wouldn't feel alone on his big day as he entered the doors of his school. His dad's fellow police officers greeted him, lining the hallway with signs and balloons to cheer him on. He's all smiles as he high-fives and gets hugs from his dad's former co-workers. And what's incredible is that his dad went to the same school, walking through those same doors for the first time back in 1988. So Maddox might not be alone. He says he's most excited about homework. We'll see how long that lasts.
In kindergarten?
Yeah. Oh. I know. My daughter had homework in kindergarten as well. It's like homework in quotation marks.
Right. Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. We have two reasons to be excited about the Mariners. Marco Gonzalez, the pitcher, is having a great season, and the rookie Kyle Lewis, who keeps hitting home runs.
Here's the stretch and the 0-1 pitch. Lewis, a swing and a high drive straightaway center field. Angle to the warning track, to the wall. Goodbye, baseball. Kyle Lewis with his fourth big league home run. This kid has been unbelievable in his major league start. Holy smokes!
So, Danny, is this indeed a glimpse at the future Mariners that we have to look forward to?
We certainly hope so. Kyle Lewis is a great story. This was a first-round draft pick who the Mariners loved an awful lot, who suffered a really serious knee injury in his first year in professional baseball. And it's been a long road back for him. The fact that he has gotten here to the major leagues and then had a historic start with four home runs in his first six games is remarkable. He went 0-for-5 yesterday in Pittsburgh, but the fact of how fast he started, it's a great sign for the Mariners. It's also really cool for him because he had to work so hard to come back from an injury that happened in a really freak collision at home plate.
So where I have, you know, I was gone for 4 months, so I have sort of a black hole of information with the Mariners. They started the season so promising. Everybody was like, hey, you know, don't look too much into this. And now it just, they kind of fizzled out. So what's to be believed about the Mariners of the future?
Well, you look for guys like Kyle Lewis. This season was never going to be measured by how many games they won. It was always going to be measured by the progress that you've seen from some of the better players, most of whom are not even in the major leagues yet. And in that regard, it's been really promising for Kyle Lewis, for Jared Kelenic, for another player named Julio Rodriguez. Those are three guys that are all in the minor leagues. Lewis is the only one that's made the majors so far, who could turn this franchise around. Those are the kind of game-changing players that they're hoping for. And Marco Gonzalez, the pitcher who won his 16th game yesterday in a shutout 6-0 of Pittsburgh, those are really promising signs. When you ask, saying gone 4 months, let me assure you, Colleen, you didn't miss much when it came to the Mariners' on-field product.
I'm kind of getting that feeling.
It was probably all things considered, it was probably best you didn't see it.
All right, good.
And Gonzalez hit a double, too.
Yeah, he did. Gonzalez can swing the bat. He was the John Olerud Player of the Year in college baseball, which is annually given to the best hitting pitcher. Because Olerud at Washington State, he was a heck of a pitcher, went on to be, and Marco can swing a little bit. So it's pretty exciting. I know he loves, there was a moment earlier this season where it was possible he was going to get to pinch hit, and he was pretty pumped about that. Marco Gonzalez has a great competitive makeup. Absolute bulldog when it comes to the way he competes, and that goes for his hitting as well as his pitching.
Okay, so Jadeveon Clowney made it. Let's talk Seahawks. He wanted out of Houston, so he ended up with the Seahawks, and now we're hearing the cornerback, Jalen Ramsey wants out of Jacksonville, but I'm hearing nothing about negative reactions to that. So fill us in there.
Well, it depends on the price, and I think that's the case in any acquisition of a veteran. Jalen Ramsey is a great player, and Jalen Ramsey was a top five pick and someone who is still has this season plus another season under contract. It depends on what Jacksonville wants for him. He doesn't like the coach. They got into a shouting match on Sunday. All sorts of different things. He also wanted to be paid. I'm fairly certain he's the guy that drove a Brinks truck to training camp to symbolize his desire to get paid.
What?
Look, if you were going to, if it's possible to trade for him, Seattle should absolutely look into it. He's one of the best corners in the league. But if it's a matter of giving up a first-round pick, or giving up two first-round picks, which has been the reported asking price from Jacksonville, for the right to give him the highest contract for a cornerback, I think that's too steep a price. But, man, Jalen Ramsey's a heck of a player.
I thought he brought a lot of baggage with him, as in drama, locker room drama.
A little bit, but I would characterize him as being significantly different than some of the other people. His seems fairly orchestrated. He doesn't seem to be someone who is as disruptive off the field as he is in the locker room. He kind of seems to be outspoken. I haven't heard of difficulty. The blow up with his coach was one of the first things that I've seen from him that would indicate like, okay, he's got some knucklehead tendencies. The other stuff is just acting like a cornerback, which is kind of an act that Deion Sanders patented 20, 25 years ago.
Oh, it wasn't Richard Sherman?
Sherman's got a little bit of that, too. Sherman certainly, and I would say that all things considered, the trade-offs with Sherman were definitely worth it. If you were going to get the same kind of player with Richard Sherman who would act the same way, I'd sign up for that 10 times out of 10.
Danny O'Neill, our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Danny, thank you.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Iran is now sending a new warning to Saudi Arabia and the U.S. not to retaliate for those attacks on Saudi oil facilities. Officials in Saudi Arabia are directly blaming Iran for those attacks. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is there now to talk it over with them. And CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Colonel Jeff McCausland joins us live now. Jeff, are we under any treaty obligation to take responsibility for retaliating for this attack?
No, we don't have any formal, to the best of my knowledge, military defense treaties with the Saudis. That being said, Saudis have been a very, very close ally for the United States for many, many years. And it goes without saying, for this particular administration, the first foreign country that Donald Trump visited after his inauguration was, in fact, Saudi Arabia. And the administration has established very, very close ties with the Saudis and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, despite the fact, of course, of accusations at the highest levels, to include the Crown Prince, being involved in the murder of a journalist by the name of Khashoggi, who was a resident of the United States right. at the time, as well as opposition to Congress, not only in the Democratic Party, but also in the president's own party, to continue supplying U.S. military hardware to the Saudis for the prosecution of the war they've been conducting in Yemen since 2015.
But on the precept that we should only get involved with wars for the sake of defending our national security, is our national security at risk here, given that we produce a lot more oil than we used to, and strictly speaking, shouldn't really need Saudi Arabia's oil?
Well, one who would support this would argue, I think, two things. One is you support your friends, because if you don't, not only does that let them down individually, but it sends a message to those that you have more formalized obligation with, perhaps, that you will not necessarily come to their assistance should they be endangered. And so there's sort of a credibility issue that I think surrounds the United States and Saudi Arabia at this particular moment. Second of all, you're quite right. We don't provide, or we don't receive, I should say, substantial amounts of oil from Saudi Arabia this time. In fact, the United States is the leading oil producer on the planet. But a large percentage of the world does. The Europeans do. The Chinese do. India do, and other places around the world. So if there was a major disruption in the exporting not only of Saudi oil, but also oil more generally coming out of the Middle East to include Qatar, UAE, Kuwait, and other places, this would have a tremendously adverse effect on the economies of Europe and all those other places, which could obviously have an indirect effect on the United States and even perhaps push the world into a broader economic downturn.
Well, then Europe and all those other places should put together a coalition along with us to back any action, right?
Well, that's right, and that's where I think, you know, in every crisis there's an opportunity, and I think the opportunity in this particular crisis would be to try to broaden the support for U.S. policies towards Iran, to try to repair some of the damage which I believe has been done in our relationships with the Europeans, and go to them and say, now is the time for you to join us in this economic sanctions, perhaps, that we have put in place against Saudi Arabia, to include the Chinese, perhaps, and the Japanese and Koreans and others, to really isolate Iran in an effort to ensure that this type of an attack does not occur in the future. Because the real concern, in many ways, is not so much just one attack. Saudi's now saying they believe they'll be back on full production by the end of the month. What's more concerning is this the harbinger of a campaign against Saudi oil facilities? And if that's the case, then world oil supplies are endangered, and we can see spot prices double almost overnight.
Yeah. Can Trump pull together a coalition like that, or is Europe still so ticked off at us over blowing up the Iran nuclear deal that they would say, you made your bed, now lie in it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's going to be very, very difficult for this administration, who has steadfastly criticized the Europeans, got into trade disagreements with the Europeans, talked about sanctions against the Europeans and the Canadians and German steel and other things, threatened sanctions or economic, I should not say sanctions, but tariff barriers against the French and others. Can he use this as an opportunity to repair those particular relationships will be a tall order. Can he also get others to cooperate, most notably the Russians and the Chinese, while we're in the midst of a major trade war with the Chinese? And obviously, U.S. relations with Russia have not been the greatest over the last several months.
So, if you were an advisor to the president, and it turns out that they have rock-solid evidence this attack came from Iranian territory, should we use the U.S. military to retaliate with some sort of attack on whatever facility launched this, even if it's on Iranian territory?
Well, I think a more synergistic approach, of course, is warranted. Military component certainly might be one of them if you got that kind of rock-solid evidence. But you have to be very careful to do that in concert with allies. Obviously, the president said, I think a bit more deferentially than he should, that we'll wait for and see what the Saudis want to do. The United States does things in its own interest, not in other countries' interest necessarily. And second of all, review the options of what exactly do you attack. Do you go after similar oil facilities in Iran? Do you go after Iranian air defense to expose the country then to further threats should this escalate? Or do you consider doing something quite different, and that perhaps is cyber attacks or some more covert attacks, which don't have quite perhaps the possibility of escalation, which could get out of control and bring us into a broader Middle Eastern conflict.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you.
Hey, great pleasure.
We are all familiar with the Harvey Weinstein story. This is the story of how the New York Times got it. Jody Kantor first reported on Weinstein with Megan Toohey, her colleague, and I asked Kantor how she went about finding women who would talk to her on the record.
Well, it was challenging because I'm not an entertainment reporter. We didn't know any actresses, so we sat around the office for a certain period saying, how would you get Gwyneth Paltrow's phone number? How would you get Uma Thurman's phone number? And remember, we couldn't go through agents or publicists because these were very private stories. And we also had to figure out, even if you get one of these women on the phone, what do you say to them in the first 45 seconds of a phone call to actually get them to trust you? Mm-hmm.
You began to realize that Harvey Weinstein knew that he had screwed up and was going to great lengths to try to compromise the women who had accused him, and even was going to go after reporters. And at one point, he hires a company or a group called Black Cube.
So, okay, in my line of work, it is not that unusual for private investigators to be digging into reporters and sometimes even to sources. It's sort of unsavory, but there's nothing illegal about it. What happened here is something much more manipulative, which is that Weinstein hired private Israeli ex-military spies. They actually took out a contract on us that says that if our article was not published, Weinstein would pay these operatives hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we found out afterwards it was actually Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker who first revealed it. But I still have the email that the Black Cube operative sent to me. And here's the craziest thing. She was in the email. She was pretending to be a women's rights advocate. She wanted me to have coffee with her, and she was basically trying to dangle money in front of me. She was saying, oh, we're doing this big sort of corporate feminism conference in London, and we want you involved, and there was sort of the implication of a big speaking fee. But I brushed her off. I was essentially saved by two things. The first thing is that the Times has really strict ethics rules, and I can't take tens of thousands of dollars from some stranger, especially connected to a business. And then the second thing is I was too busy. I was too busy. We had the responsibility of executing the Weinstein story. My partner, Megan, and I also have very young kids at home, and we, you know, we wanted to get the story and get the kids to bed.
I feel you there. So the night before this story publishes, what's going through your brain? What's going through your heart? What's going through your stomach? I can't imagine how nerve-wracking this might be.
It was the responsibility. We knew that nobody had gotten this story. And at that point, we also understood that we were dealing with 25 years of allegations. How could this kind of alleged behavior have gone unchecked for so long? How could so many people have helped Harvey Weinstein instead of the women?
But these women also had lawyers who went along with this. Lisa Bloom, you also point out her mom, Gloria Allred, who has this reputation as a feminist. You make it sound like women like this were actually complicit because they advised the accusers to take these settlements and shut up about it.
Okay, so let's talk about the issue of secret settlements for sexual abuse, because this is something we all need to think about, because these agreements are still being signed every day across the United States. Believe it or not, this is sort of our country's standard way of dealing with sexual harassment, sexual assault allegations often, which is that a woman who's faced something terrible will go to an attorney, and she's expecting, you know, the law to somehow make it right. And what the attorney will often say to her is, your best option is a secret settlement. You can take money, but it's money for silence. You can never tell anybody about this again. So when you're in that situation individually, it can seem like the best thing to do, because you get to keep your privacy, you get to move on, et cetera, et cetera. But what we've now been able to see collectively, not just with the Weinstein story, but the Bill O'Reilly story, the Larry Nassar story, is that these settlements have a tendency to enable abuse, because the men can just pay the women to be silent, and then they can go on to potentially hurt somebody again. And so I think we're having now a kind of reckoning over the work that Gloria Allred and many, many, many other attorneys do. And I think the question is this really the best we can do in terms of addressing this problem in this country?
What do you think has changed since this reckoning began with your reporting?
You know, what's so confounding is that everything has changed and nothing has changed. On the one hand, there was this mass firing of people like Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer and Mario Batali, and we've never really seen that kind of accountability before. Lots of corporations are taking this much more seriously. I think there's a recognition that even lower-level behaviors, like a lot of things that happen in high school, like bra snapping or patting girls' butts as they walk down the hallway, is not okay. However, when we look at our laws and our structures and our systems, they haven't really changed. It's still really hard to report a claim like this, especially for low-income workers, for a waitress who's getting groped by her boss as she, you know, waits tables for $10 an hour. It's hard to say that anything has really changed for that woman.
Jody Kantor from the New York Times. Her new book with Megan Toohey is titled simply, She Said. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.